There's only one snack that can make me feel like I'm having the true movie theater experience, and that's popcorn. When my mom and I hang in for a girls' night, we have to get our fix, and that's where Kelly's Killer Popcorn comes in. They're a small batch gourmet popcorn company, and believe me, one bite and you'll be hooked. Made in Austin, Texas, this family-owned business has tons of flavors. My mom loves their salted agave caramel, while I have a hard time picking between black pepper or dill pickle. Maybe I'll just mix the bags together. Oh, and when my dad and brother crash our girls' night, you know that spicy nacho popcorn is coming out. Every flavor is popped in 100% real butter and is whole grain and gluten-free. Which flavor will you be choosing? Head on over to kellyskillerpopcorn.com to indulge yourself in some scary good gourmet popcorn. And make sure to tag them on Instagram at kellyskillerpopcorn so that they can see what movie you're pairing with their flavors. That's kellyskillerpopcorn.com for American-made, small-batch, delicious popcorn. This is The Gala Show. I'm your reporter on the beat, Gala Avery. On this episode, you may know my guest as a lover of film, a Praetorian guard of cinema, or even as an ally to filmmakers all over the world. Even if you don't know his face, there's a good chance that he has been your shepherd on celluloid, both repairing prints that make their way all over or projecting for Los Angeles theaters such as the New Beverly Cinema. He is the lead projectionist at the New Beverly, but on The Gala Show, I simply know him as Un Chien Andalou, David Chien. Hi, David.
Hey, Gala.
So it's kind of weird, but people are going to assume that I know David because of the New Beverly connection, but that's not true.
That's not true at all.
It's actually really weirdly not true. David and I met because during COVID, I had a very small film club that was on Letterboxd, and I guess David found the link on Discord. I don't really know.
In truth, I don't even really know. I can't recall exactly how I found you on Letterboxd.
I know how you found me is because we have a Fred Daw and Roxanne Mosqueda in common.
Oh, that might have been why
that was how we found each
feed.
Other on Letterboxd. Mm-hmm. But then you found me on Discord, and it was funny because David, like, I knew nothing about him. He just had like no profile picture, and his username was Un Chien Andalou. I have no idea who this guy is, and we kind of figured out, okay, he's from LA, and he does something with film, kind of, and we had no idea. We're all gossiping about him, like, who is this guy? Who is he? And then finally, when we did the One-Armed Executioner screening, David was like, you know, Gala, there's something I should tell you.
I will be running that show.
And then I met David, but it was weird because everyone thought I knew David from the Bev, but no, I don't know him just because he's the projectionist of extraordinaire, my shepherd who watches over me, my angel.
Well, there was that weird anxiety of coming out of the closet that I'm actually in the booth. I project film because I also didn't want to throw things off as far as in the dialogue and Discord in that server. I didn't want it to seem like I was finger wagging as far as, hey, you know about that print or about this particular engagement.
Yeah, but I mean, what I like about like our little film club is that everyone is so different and that everyone has like their own like input. Like there's film students, there's people that work with celluloid, there's people that have nothing to do with movies that have never seen a movie before, it feels like. But we all get along. But anyway, that's how I know David, and that's why he is Un Chien Andalou to me, which I still haven't seen, but one day I will.
And when I was a really snooty, budding film connoisseur in middle school, that's when I discovered Buñuel. And I had always had this very strong affinity, not knowing any French, of course, that there was this classic surrealist short film that literally had my spelling, C-H-I-E-N, yeah, for my surname. And of course, you know, it is dog in French, which I also embrace.
Yeah, you embrace it fully. So before we bring up the topic for today, I have a question for you. So you're a father. I love your son, and I love his middle name. Has your view of cinema, or rather the kinds of movies that you love and want to watch, changed with fatherhood?
Well, interestingly, no. In fact, I feel like all the changes, and there are, of which there are many, but if anything, maybe I do go through that introspection as far as the films that I watch, the films that I love, the films that I anticipate sharing with him, because I...
Well, he's too young to even watch a movie right now, right?
Right.
Or is he watching yet?
Well, in fact, yesterday... So he's come to the theater, whether at the New Bev. He's probably honestly been the most behaved at the New Bev, but this was when he was still literally an infant, because mm-hmm. last summer in 2022, My wife was able to bring him for the matinee shows because we would all drive together and then leave together. And I kind of like those shorter shifts where I come in at noon, I bounce by 5 or 6. He stayed for this beautiful IB Tech of Sleeping Beauty.
Okay, and Sleeping Beauty is his first movie?
And he was a Sleeping Beauty during most of that show, which is why he was tolerable. But he actually was awake and pretty attentive for the screening we had of Beauty and the Beast, which is probably my favorite.
So he's still
a
beauty.
He's still a beauty and a little bit of a beast.
Just a little bit.
Those were the two films in particular where he could last through the whole thing. I mean, speaking of Saw Patrol, to date this particular conversation.
Because my friend Blake, who's also in our film club, and I are about to go do Saw Patrol on Wednesday. Blake called me out. We were in the theater for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And I was like, Paw Patrol movie, haha, I'm going to go see that. And he was like, I'll go see it with you if we go see Saw beforehand. And I was like, ha, Saw Patrol, ha, ha, ha. Yeah, he called me on my bluff. Now I have to go watch the Paw Patrol movie.
You got to be really careful with these ideas that you shoot out into the ether. Well, my wife was she had taken him to Paw Patrol, and he lasted, I think, the opening song, and then just had to...
She'd take him to Saw.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't condone it, not because of the content, or actually because of the content, not because of the gore, but I was kind of disappointed in Saw 10.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet. Okay, full disclosure, though, I haven't seen any Saw movie.
Saw is one of those weird things, even perhaps like Fast and Furious, where without even intending to, I'm completely caught up. I know the lore inside and out.
Really?
I get the whole infrastructure of what they're doing. I do prefer Saw, actually, over Fast and Furious in terms of the overall trajectory. Although I do think I was not crazy at all about Spiral or this new one. But I'm one of the few defenders of the eighth one, which was Jigsaw.
Okay, well, I haven't seen any of them, so I will go see Saw. And I will go see Paw Patrol. And I don't know anything about Paw Patrol either. This is me. This is me in 2023. I'm trying new things. I'm seeing movies in theaters. Oh my gosh. Is there a movie, though, that you are excited to show your son when he's old enough?
Yeah. Well, so going back to that, I think the introspection about what to show him, and I, of course, get a lot of input, encouragement, and
do's like and don'ts.
Do's and don'ts from Jessica, because I was both lucky and also cursed with the ability to have watched a lot of movies I should not have watched.
You call that blursed when you're blessed and cursed.
my parents blursed me with sort of carte blanche, because I think they were hesitant about movies with too much sex and nudity. Although, you know, that obviously there was a lot of things that passed through the filter, but they really didn't mind me watching violent stuff. And
like what?
Well, I remember one of my prized memories, because my dad admittedly bootlegged a lot of things for me on VHS. And so
fighting,
I remember
fighting
the good fight. I remember my copy of RoboCop.
Which is one of your favorite movies.
I mentioned before we started recording, kind of sort of always a toss up between They Live and RoboCop. And with RoboCop, I remember writing as a lark on like the scratched off label. I wrote rated R. No one under 5 admitted, because I was 5 at the time that I wrote this, and I kind of reshaped the rating system to appease my own standards that, hey, I was 5. I think once you're 5, you're old enough for RoboCop.
Okay, so your son at 5 for his 5th birthday.
Well, I you know, when Jessica was pregnant in the summer of 2021, she had never seen RoboCop, and then we watched it together at the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I of course love it. She enjoyed it. But I think she was concerned about the idea that we would show this to our son before the age of 10.
I think 10's a pretty good. 10's a pretty good.
I think that's a good. I'll agree that we can kind of edge the
age. Just add 5 years.
Add 5 years. Anything I'm thinking, just add 5 years.
Now, as always, my guest gets to bring their topic to the mic. David, what is the topic that we're going to be talking about today, and why did you decide to choose it?
It didn't take a lot of soul searching to land on film projection.
Wow, I would never have guessed that's what we're going to talk about.
I feel like if you decided to talk about literally anything else, I would rope in film projection somehow.
Yeah, like, Dave, like, let's talk about cheeseburgers. That's what I'm talking with Joe Dante about coming on, and I was like, Joe, you could talk about anything you want, even cheeseburgers. And so now I just keep telling people that.
I feel like Joe probably could talk a lot about cheeseburgers.
I know he could.
There's probably a whole movie orgy segment about cheeseburger ads. Well, that's the thing. I was going to say, like, I probably could have, if the topic were cheeseburgers, probably the first thing I would talk about are the 35 millimeter tags that are all burger related that we had just chosen for like a pre-show. But first, time for a commercial break.
I might be vegetarian, but that doesn't mean I can't enjoy a good spice rub. My favorite place to get them is Smoke Bros, a veteran-owned and operated business that sells premium handcrafted dry rubs, spice blends, and seasonings. Psst, guys, you can even put it on your popcorn. My favorites are Honey Badger, because he doesn't give a bleep, and jelly and peanut flavor topping, because some things just taste better together. The website even has recipes, so go check out smokedbros.com to support a veteran-owned and operated business and fill your cabinet with delicious flavor.
And we're back.
That's our topic for today, 35 millimeter film. And also, I'm guessing 70 and 16 and Super 8, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. Every format's on the table.
Every format's on the table. 30 minutes on the clock, and our time starts now.
Man, 30 minutes. Okay.
Well, David, I'll start off by, because people probably don't know this, how did you get started as a projectionist?
I was very lucky in that Jules, who is the director of operations at the New Beverly.
Also known as Unruly Julie to those Video Archives fans.
It's so funny because I, having only known Julie as Jules, it's really interesting when I think about Unruly Julie and even seeing that like on, you know, some of
Unruly Julie, Jules McLean.
Special thanks, I know. Well, I started working at the New Bev shortly after they reopened at the end of 2018. And I was part of the floor staff, the front of house operations. And that was great because I think after going in and out of all these different jobs within film production and just film in general, everything from working on my own short films to being a script supervisor to producing to doing some editing. But my favorite part by far whenever I was working on some friend's project was going to film festivals, going to theaters to watch something together. So movie theaters have always been a part of my life. Movie exhibition has always been it is the goal for anyone working in production to a large extent. But the opportunity to work at the New Bev was really special because I've been going to the New Beverly as a patron, as an audience member since October of 2001 when I started college in that year. Wow. And my first double bill there was Brother. It was a Kitano, Takeshi Kitano double bill of Brother, which was in its second run, and Sonatine.
Wow. I want them to almost get all the staff of the Bev together and have them do like a week of here's what we first saw here.
Yeah. You would have a pretty good variety of double bills, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And so I would say it was a few months into working at the New Bev that it really crystallized how much I wanted to learn more about the technical aspects upstairs in the booth. And Jules, and also at the time, who was there more present, Brian Quinn, they were both really accommodating as far as creating that pathway to do some training, to kind of test the waters. And I guess there's a lot of other details to get into, but one of the things that I think really helped my confidence and also their confidence in me is that at the time, the lead projectionist, Lindsay, who had been teaching me for about a month or maybe even a little less than a month, there was a set of circumstances where a bit of an emergency came up and I was really the only one available to come in and to run a matinee of Interview with the Vampire.
Oh my gosh.
And what's funny about that is I felt confident enough to say that I was confident enough because there were still little things here and there that I hadn't practiced enough at the time.
Out of the frying pan and into the fire. Like, oh, yeah. You were just like thrown in, like get going, like do it.
Yeah. Slid right into a live show very early on. And that was a pretty success. My changeovers were perhaps a little fast. I was a little too trigger happy, but very eager. But it was a pretty smooth show. And I think this is true too, since I've recently trained a bunch of the projectionists who currently are part of the staff, who are all really great, really talented.
Who are my angels. I tell David every single time I'm there, I love knowing who's projecting. Okay, some of them don't want me to know who's projecting because in case something happens. But I love the feeling that there is someone in the booth that is watching over me and that is watching over and like shepherding my experience. I find it just incredibly comforting. I don't know if I'm the only one. And I sit in my seat at the Bev because David told me he can see me. It's like literally why I still sit there.
I think all those years of watching Mystery Science Theater 3000, you begin to understand the nuances of people's silhouettes from behind. It's kind of like a sort of a fingerprint of sort.
Yeah. And apparently I have a distinct one. So David knows when I'm there.
But of course, your mom could certainly be a stand-in.
Oh, yeah. My mom, especially when we saw Twilight.
Yes.
And then my mom met you and we were at Twilight. Because David and I both admittedly like Twilight. So that's a conversation for another time, though. So.
And fortunately, that was one of the early film series that my then girlfriend, now wife, we sort of bonded and had a real blast watching the Twilight Saga. And it is indeed a saga.
It is a saga. I know. I took my dad to go see that when we were he had never seen any of them, and he went with me to Breaking Dawn Part 2.
Having like, not seen any of the other films.
Speaking of like not seeing franchises and just walking right in. And I remember he was so pumped though. He was like, this is like a multi-million dollar YouTube video. Like, and there's that sequence where they're fighting and then like, not to give it away. Cause I mean, if you haven't seen Twilight yet, what are you doing with your life? Go see Twilight. But there's like a whole switch up thing. My mind was blown. I love Twilight. I could go on and on about Twilight facts. So.
Well, the spoiler alerts be damned. I would say that I'd imagine Roger thinking, are there beheadings in all the Twilight films?
That's literally like what it was, exactly that. And it's so funny because I was there opening night like for Twilight. Like it was the biggest event of like my teenage years, like Twilight. Like I tell everyone, we used to read the book in honors English and we acted out scenes from the book in class. That's how nerdy it was. But so you were doing Interview with a Vampire and you just kind of got thrust in and now you're training people.
Speaking of vampires,
it's a vampire. What was the tagline for Twilight that you were telling me?
Or the tagline for From Dusk Till Dawn.
Oh yeah, From Dusk Till Dawn.
Which was, at the time, it was like a year removed from the Anne Rice adaptation of Interview with the Vampire. So the tagline was vampires, no interviews.
And here we are, it's all vampires all day, every day here at...
Yeah, it's interesting to think that. I mean, one of my most memorable shows at the New Bev was the midnight screening of Twilight from 2022.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, it was, because it goes without saying that the most evenings, the audience, the gender breakdown, it skews more male than female.
Typically, yes.
Typically, but then you have a midnight show like Twilight or an Aquamarine, and you've got like 90-95% women in the audience.
And you can always tell by how long the women's restroom line is. Like, oh, yeah. At Phantom, there was a line. I couldn't get into the restroom, so I knew that my fellow females were representing. They were in the crowd. I always love it.
All the beef fans.
All the beef heads. I'm a beef head. I'm a beef head. I love beef. First off, I love Garrett Graham. So, of course, I love Garrett Graham. But then also, I love Ray Kennedy, who does the singing for...
Yes.
I love him, and I love his voice. So, I'm a beef head.
Off of our recent screening of Phantom of the Paradise, Armando, who was the projectionist running things that night, when I went upstairs after he closed out the show...
35 on 35.
You know, our good old Armando celebrating his 35th year in projection. And I think he started when he was in his teens. I'm jealous of that because I think, again, when I got into working projection at the New Bev, once I was in that groove, it occurred to me how long I had been thinking. It triggered a memory. Like when I was younger, and this was back when it was young David writing the rated R, No One Under 5 Admitted.
Yeah.
I actually remember putting up signs on every door of the house I grew up in where... in this den, Uncle Buck is playing. Like I pretended they were
different auditoriums
of a theater because I was citing places like the both these theaters are now gone. The UA Del Amo, which was a multiplex.
Oh yeah, the Del Amo.
And then also the having grown up in the South Bay here in SoCal, I also remember the General Cinemas had a three structure. I think a total of like six or seven screens where the South Bay Galleria still is. But you know, their theater now is an AMC multiplex within the mall, But I remember putting up all the different marquees on like just a sheet of paper in front of like the bedroom or the bathroom doors, pretending that my home was a multiplex.
You saw into the future.
I saw into the future. This is really roundabout, but I was talking about Armando because 35 on 35.
Yeah.
When I went into the booth after he closed out Phantom, he just turned to me and said, "You know, I think this movie is about beef. He's the MVP."
Yeah. Well, okay. So it's so funny with Phantom of the Paradise specifically, during Hell of It, I have a memory of seeing this scene, but I think it's been implanted by my father, like into my child brain, that I think I've seen it, but I think he just told me about it. But during Hell of It, there was supposed to be this whole tap dancing on a coffin sequence. Do you know about this?
No.
So yeah, so Paul Williams has told this story, and I guess my dad knew Paul because like Rules of Attraction and all that stuff, but apparently there was a sequence that they filmed, and I think the scene was deleted, where it was Beef's funeral, and it's during Hell of It, and I guess he's filming the funeral. Paul Williams. I can't remember the name right now. Paul Williams is filming, and Swan is filming, and like a little girl comes and starts tap dancing on the coffin to Hell of It. And so it's like, it's all about Beef's death as being like broadcast to the world. And I remember seeing that scene, but apparently it doesn't exist. But
so you created the scene in your mind because of what Roger had.
Yes, described. But Paul Williams has described it as being shot. Wow. But I've never seen it. Apparently.
Yeah.
I was waiting for the tap dancing on the coffin the entire movie. I was like, where's the tap dancing on the coffin? I thought it was at the end credits. Like, I don't know. It was weird.
It's an interesting false memory to have implanted by almost a game of telephone.
Yeah. And I looked it up afterwards, and Paul Williams has spoken about it. So it does exist somewhere, but just not anywhere that I would have witnessed it.
Yeah, it's one of those things too where, and this kind of does tie into film exhibition as far as these days. I value incredibly whatever home video special edition versions of movies we can still get in this current era. Mm-hmm. And there's still companies doing some really good work.
And special features too. It's like, there's a dying.
Yeah.
Sad.
Yeah. I feel like the notion of even seeing a commentary track, by default coming into a release of a film, like it's become a bit of a novelty. Mm-hmm. And I even find that when companies like Criterion are putting out titles, it seems like they're sourcing older commentary tracks.
Yeah. They're not generating new ones necessarily.
Yeah. Not necessarily.
So do you only project 35? Because the Bev doesn't do 70.
Right. There's no 70 at the Bev. And I guess.
Did you learn 70 somewhere else, or did you just never got around to it? I don't know.
Well, this is where I guess I am a little bit of an outlier, because every single person in the current, team in the booth at the Bev, there's only me and one other person. No, that's not true. Actually, I'm the only person who prior to the Bev has not had any projection experience. Wow. You know, some people have had mainly digital projection, setting up the DCPs and all that, or ingesting all the digital trailers. One of the other projectionists, she had almost exclusively worked with 70 millimeter at another venue. And as you know, one of our projectionists projects 8 millimeter.
Yeah, Davey.
Davey B. Gravy.
Davey B. Gravy's Tiny Cinema, which you can look up online and go chase around and figure out how to see some tiny films. But yeah, so you specifically then specialize in 35.
Right. I only know 35, and I only know it through the gateway of the Bev booth. We do have 16. And 16,
do you run the 16 shows?
Yeah, we do. Whenever we run 16 these days, it's mostly cartoons or live action shorts. There are some instances where the only print we can source for a feature is 16, or maybe mm-hmm. there's a 16 print in house that we
want to
show.
I think that happened with Mad Monster Party. I think it ended up being on 16, and then, yep. Yeah.
Mad Monster Party. I definitely run that. I actually remember in one particular case, I think I found out after the fact that Paul Thomas Anderson was in attendance.
Oh, great.
Which warmed my heart, because I think the prior time I had seen him in attendance, and this is like just before I started projecting, he was there for Bugsy Malone. He's a real family matinee kind of
Man, I gotta start going to family matinees then. Like, I'm never there at the family matinee time. I have like my very specific, like I like Monday, the first movie on Mondays. That's always like what I like the best on the calendars too. I tend to like that.
I think that's another thing too. We tend to gravitate. I mean, the new Bev is so unique as far as how 24/7 it is. Mm-hmm. And not 24 per se, but like 7 days a week it is.
Yeah, 7 days a week. And there's family matinees, there's midnights, there's double features. Like, you can really go, if you like movies, you can see a movie at any time, really.
there are the rare instances, we haven't done it in a while, but there are some instances like when we have bookings of Heat, mm-hmm. or Raimi's Spider-Man, the demand for it is so insane that we do open up like a 10 a.m. special encore.
Oh, wow.
And those were really fun. I remember being there for like a 10 a.m. Heat because you couldn't pack enough people.
That's awesome. Heat at 10 a.m.?
My favorite memory of watching movies as a kid is just in consideration of expenses, you know, when my dad largely took, I mean, both my mom and dad and my grandmother took me to movies all the time. But in particular with my dad, he would have the day off on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. We'd hit up Galleria del Amo, another great theater by the Del Amo Mall called The Man 9, which is also defunct.
That's so sad.
I mean, The Man 9 in particular had like the best sound. And I remember, you know, Heat played there for a long time. I actually didn't see Heat during its original run, but I bring all this up because there are so many great memories of going to like 10 a.m. shows on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. And sometimes seeing the heavy hitters early in the morning on a weekday somehow resonated more. That's why running something like Heat at 10 a.m., this is pre-pandemic, it triggered a nice memory of what it was like to go to those movies early in the morning when you were still like fresh and, you know, pretty much like the press screening schedule.
Like bleary eyed. Do you have a favorite movie that you've projected at the Bev?
Man, there's so many.
Well, I know that you recently had that Father's Day screening where you got to screen that movie on Father's Day.
Right.
And that one hadn't screened in a while. So that was kind of a cool screening.
That's a great pull. Basically, there were two films that I had helped bring to the table as far mm-hmm. as the calendars were concerned. So earlier this year on Father's Day, I was able to project Patrick Wang's In the Family. It was a one night only show and it was on a Sunday. And it was just a really beautiful thing because of the fact that, you know, the movie doesn't screen very much. I personally consider it one of the best movies of the 2010s.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very friendly with Patrick, the writer, director, and
star
of it.
You're friendly with everyone. You're friendly with everyone. That's the thing about David. David just knows everyone. David's like, oh, I just talked to this person. Oh, I know this. You are a man about town, a man about cinema.
Well, that's also the nice thing about the community at large, as far as if you go to enough screenings, if you really have a humility about the act of going to movies and engaging with that community, naturally, and also if you're not creepy, or maybe if you are too creepy.
No. Let's put the big disclaimer. Do not be creepy.
Yeah, do not be creepy, although certainly
you can be interesting, though.
You can be interesting.
And you can be yourself, but just don't be creepy.
I think sometimes that quirky, creepy borderline.
You need like the right amount, like I don't know, like 25% creepy, 75% quirky or something, maybe.
Right. I think maybe the enthusiasm that can aid some in engaging with the community at large can be read as creepy. But I'm really grateful for the fact that I've been able to have good relationships with a number of folks who've made films that I really admire. Because the other example I was going to cite is in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, everything's zipping
it's all
by.
A blur.
So the summer of 2022, at the end of July, if I recall, we were able to do a 3-day run of The Brown Bunny.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, and it was an interesting set of circumstances there because I know Vincent Gallo personally. How we met always makes me laugh because I saw him crossing the street in Little Tokyo here in downtown LA. This was in 2014. And then I couldn't believe my eyes that it was Vincent. And so I just go, Vincent. And then he just comes up to me and shakes my hand like he recognized me.
Like he knew you.
And then it was like a hot summer day. We were next to a dumpster behind a restaurant and just proceeded standing there. Like from the moment we locked eyes and started talking, we just stood there without moving an inch for like an hour. And then at the time I had just bought like this limited Australian release of the Brown Bunny soundtrack. And so I was just talking to him about that. And he was telling me all these great stories about everything from like Michael Bay to Stallone. I mean, he's a raconteur to be sure, but The Brown Bunny doesn't screen very much. That movie is one of my favorites of the 2000s. And it was a really great opportunity because I also happened to help him like work on this limited Blu-ray release of it. And part of that whole dialogue was that eventually we could bring a print of the film to the new Bev. And those were three sold out nights. It was wonderful because Vincent did an intro all three nights.
And I've heard about this legendary intro.
Oh, I mean, night one, 5 minute intro. Night two, he's feeling more comfortable, like 10 minute intro. And then the third night, which I know Vincent perhaps has mixed feelings about. He's a very private guy, but he's also just such a great storyteller. And, you know, people, for all the people who goof on him, but there's people who really love him and really genuinely appreciate his voice.
For sure.
And so that, if I'm not mistaken, I think that last night was like an hour long intro.
That's such a gift, though, to give the audience. Honestly, that is such a gift because people go there. That's one of the great things about the Bev is that you can go there and all of a sudden the filmmaker will be there. And that's also why I think projecting on film is so important. Also, like, I feel like projections are kind of unsung heroes in my hobby. You guys are really helping filmmakers who like did stuff on film get it shown in the format that I feel like it was meant to. So thanks, David.
Well, thank you. Or you're welcome. But thank you. Thank you for saying that.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. It's very hard work, and I hope more people appreciate it. But no, in all seriousness, I keep going back to the humility of it because I really did come into this particular job at the New Bev with the least amount of experience. And I really, you know, I busted my ass as far as making sure that I learned everything and absorbed as much as I could and can, because it is certainly the case that even though there's kind of a fixed nature to film projection, like there hasn't been a bunch of innovation in the last 10 or 20 years as far as how film projection works. But the innovation, I suppose, comes from every single print coming at you requiring literally every print that you handle requires a slightly different thing as far as workflow.
It's almost like music.
It's like music, yeah. It's live performance. I mean, that's...
You are the conductor, essentially. Like, you are shepherding us. And I think also what people don't understand is that, I don't want to call it restoration, because I'm not sure if that's the right word, but whenever a print comes to you, you do look it over. Like, that's, like, basically, maybe you can explain to people what happens when a print comes to you guys.
Yes. Well, that's a huge thing. And it's something that sometimes we commiserate about in the booth because... and I get it. Like, we're afforded the luxury of having time if we need time to go through every print very carefully, because that's first and foremost is really treating this craft, treating the materials in an archival safe venue and workflow. And so every single thing that we handle and every single thing that gets put into the projector, nothing gets put into the projectors, nothing gets threaded until we've had a chance to look at it, so that there are no rips, tears, breaks, scratches that we're not aware of. I mean, we're certainly aware of some damaged prints and it might compromise the show to some extent, but I think we do a really good job. I would dare say we're on the level of where museums have screening facilities. I really believe that we have, and I even think maybe even more so, just because we work more often than a lot of the museums can. Like, the museums are not showing 35 millimeter 7 days a week. So we're afforded that luxury, and we're afforded being in a venue that pushes us to only work on film in that capacity. So we really have to, like, repair, be aware, make notes for other projectionists so that they know what quirks, what focus drift, what framing issues, printing issues. Sometimes the films come to us with a printing issue that we can't even really do anything about. So we just have to, like, tell the audience in advance or let the managers know in case we have to field any questions or complaints.
Yeah, I know, like, for example, like, for The Loved One, that print came, and I think it was edited for TV print, basically, because it had big segments missing out of it. So it was fascinating to see it in that format. And I know that it goes through your guys' hands. And I also love that you guys are basically, if there is an issue with a print, you guys are fixing it so that when it goes to the next repertory theater and to be screened by the next person, the next projectionist, it's almost in better quality than it was when it first entered the Bev.
That's a big thing for us. I do think anything that passes through our booth leaves as good, if not in better condition. In fact, when we have like a print from a private collector like Larry Karaszewski, I think his 16 mil print of Buster and Billy came in and it required some repairs and it played fine.
Thank you to Larry, who was the greatest of all time for lending that print when we needed it.
Yeah, no, that was a treat. I think that was, I'm sure for 95% of the people in attendance, that was like their first time watching it. And certainly maybe the first time they ever, first time they saw it, period, but also first time they saw it on film. And I know that we sent it back to Larry in better shape and mm-hmm. it was all repaired. And I was also going to say, you know, the example I always cite, and I've often mentioned this to people who are coming into the booth to train and who are all like currently working at the booth, is that a print like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and this is true for all of the Quentin prints because they get like the most consistent mileage because we always have the Quentin Midnights on Fridays. Yes. But the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood print, which we've had since 2019 when the movie first came out, and we play, I mean, that movie, the mileage on that print from all of its play at the Bev, because we were so diligent about cleaning after every reel finished, that we were always very careful about threading, and that we had such strict standards, as any booth should, but not often will.
Or did way in the past.
Or did way in the past. I mean, I actually came into this conversation remembering fondly of all the times I went to the multiplex, largely watching plattered prints. But if I'm honest with myself, I would say a good third of those experiences were compromised. I didn't mind it as a kid, but if I could travel back in time and sit in, I'm sure that there was like way more scratches, way more platter damage, way more like flubbed builds, like splice points where you might hear a pop or something because of a bad tape job. I certainly remember film running off the gears.
Did you ever have it like disintegrate before your eyes?
You know, I don't think I've ever seen, well, funny enough, I did see a burn at the New Bev before I started working there. But it was, I mean, this is such a weird tangent, but it was for this Radiohead music video that Paul Thomas Anderson made for different theaters. And I forgot the name of the video, but it ends with a shot of Tom York looking at fire and then in the foreground, and then the film burned because it got stuck.
Oh my God, but that's kind of perfect. That's kind of kismet in a weird way.
It was kismet, and I you know, I have a very fond memory of it, but of course whoever was running it that night, and I know it's not it's a blemish whenever that happens, like for a booth and for booth protocol, but that's, I guess, the thing about analog. Even like these technical snafus can lend itself to an incredibly memorable and very serendipitous sort of symmetry. But not to go too off topic, but going back to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I mean, you know, we run that movie pretty regularly, or, you know, a few times a year. I mean, that exact same print from 2019 has very little wear. It still looks great. And that's, I think, one of the things that annoy, I mean, we all love to some extent scratches and the vintageness of film and the grain and the natural
wear. The Eastman pink, which I love.
Yeah. When there's fade, I mean, Eastman fade. So like, that's funny too, right? Eastman fade tends to take on that more prominent red or orange flare, mm-hmm. but then there's something like Fuji fade where it's actually not that bad at all. It's kind of a little bit of a purple tint. But the thing about it is that you have a newer print, something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that has a bunch of mileage accrued over the last few years. But if a print is handled well, it can stand up to a lot of play. And if people know what they're doing with the print, it's not going to look significantly degraded or distractingly damaged. And I think that's also one of the things too about, if it's like if people talk about a vinyl record, oh, I just love hearing the hisses and
the
pops.
Yeah.
And it's like, but also if you have a good turntable and if you're diligent about how you maintain your records, you don't necessarily hear those things. Like there's an aspect to it that I appreciate and an aspect to it that also is just like bad handling.
Yeah, because if you keep it clean and you treat your objects well, they will last you longer mm-hmm. than if you just don't do the proper protocols. And it's like that with anything. It's like that with DVDs. Like, don't scratch the back of your DVDs. Make sure you put them back.
Right. And the DVD thing also lends itself to whenever we have digital tracks. I mean, the thing that I think people don't realize is you could be watching something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but the sound is digital. You know, we're reading it off of the Dolby Digital, what looks like QR codes in between the perfs on one side of the film. And if that gets damaged, you have to default to the optical track, which is the standard SR analog track that sits right next to picture. And so digital is very unforgiving, but if it's treated correctly, there's no damage and it runs well. I don't think people realize that even in the warmth and the beauty of celluloid imagery, the incredible sound mixes that you can experience at places like the Bev are digitally sourced or encoded.
That's a good point. What advice would you have for someone who wants to get into projecting? Because I imagine there are a lot of people that just don't know where to start or don't even know they can do it.
That's a tough one. I think there are so few venues. There's certainly no venue like the New Bev.
Yeah, no.
Then, any venue that even has some like occasional part-time film projection exhibition, I would say just seek out any place that, I know there's a university, I want to say it's in North Carolina, but I could be wrong, but I know there is one specific school that does have a whole program for film projection. Mm. And maybe the best route is that you're more likely to find film archive work at a museum or a film institute than you would film projection at a theater, just because, I mean, there's so few theaters that even can afford or want to run film and deal with that hassle. Because, I mean, it is a big hassle, but we don't think of it as a hassle because the rewards are so great. They're like ridiculous. The dividends you get paid in terms of film projection are 100-fold if you know what to look for. But to your question and to that end, I think anyone who's really interested in film, the more likely way to navigate that is either shooting on film and getting experience that way.
That's a really good point, yeah.
Yeah, and that's doesn't have to be expensive, because I think even still photography, though not motion picture photography, there's a lot of the same principles that overlap. Mm-hmm. That Venn diagram has a lot of overlap.
Yeah, it's just, it's film.
It's film, and you know, you learn literally a frame at a time, as opposed to zipping through, you know, whole 1,000-foot mags.
Yeah, and there's also different formats. You can do 120. You can, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So there's tons of stuff.
I even think, even though it's not really the same, but even a Fuji or Polaroid camera that gives you those instant
gratification.
Yeah, you do learn on a very basic level the analog and the sort of the finite nature of that one thing.
And the precious, like it. Costs you money every single time that you take a picture, and you really want to make it count. Then
it's, I think, the good side of materialism. Yeah. I think we all kind of relegated materialism as a pejorative term, but the materialism involved.
Oh, you hit your 30 minutes.
That's so fast.
I know, but you did a good job. You covered a lot, David. We got all the way to the pejorative term of materialism.
And I guess we leave that for people to chew on
and figure out. Our time is up, but David, is there any final thought that you would like to leave the audience with?
Oh, a 30-minute thought. No. I would say whenever you have an opportunity to go to the movies and watch films with an audience, that's obviously the best way to go, even though audiences admittedly are incredibly bad as far as form and...
But it starts with us.
It starts with us
going to the movie and being that good member of the audience.
Not that I want people to pick fights, and there's certainly very dangerous scenarios to get yourself into with the wrong personalities, let's just say.
Getting a fist fight over cinema.
But that's the thing. I think it's okay to shush people as long as it's warranted. I think it's good to set that example. And whether your theater is running film or digital, a lot of that proper behavior starts with how you bring your own attitude into that seat. But more than anything, if you have an opportunity to watch film projected, if you open yourself up to that experience, that whole debate of whether or not it's good to watch something on film, I mean, I think at this point, I objectively think it is. It's not to say that you can't have a great experience with the fidelity and the qualities of 4K digital projection, but that's just a different thing. In the same way that watching 35 versus 70 millimeter, they're two very different experiences.
Yeah, and 8 and 16 is all different.
Watching something on VHS versus Blu-ray at home on a small TV, or like a tube television versus a flat screen. I mean,
yeah, or going to the Hollywood Bowl and watching it projected on the screen there with an orchestra. It's all about just how you see something.
Yeah, exactly. There is no definitive. And I think the idea is just like where you have dinner with someone changes the experience of that meal, changes the experience of that conversation. How you and I are talking now in these particular great purple
David loves
armchairs.
My purple chairs.
Like I think us sitting in this purple armchair changes the dialogue in ways that we can't
if
fathom.
I was on my orange couch versus these purple chairs.
Yeah, if we were on a sofa, if we're sitting on the floor, if we were in like director's chairs, I mean, like I guess the idea is, you know, if you humble yourself to the idea that all these different modes of the setting and the format and the presentation, if you open yourself up to how that changes your experience, then it's not about finding the definitive. It's just about really looking at the variety as a collective whole and how rich it is that we can, you know, seek out different versions of something.
Thank you, David, for coming on to the show. If you are in the Los Angeles area, you can head on over to the New Beverly Cinema and catch a film, because there is a good chance that David will be the one projecting it. I'm Gala Avery, and this has been The Gala Show.
The Gala Show is brought to you by Insertomatic. This episode was executive produced by Roger Avery and produced by Gala Avery. Music composed by Andy Milburn. As always, I'm your host, Gala Avery. Copyright 2023, all rights reserved.
Despite me sharing the same last name with this charity, I don't have any affiliation with it, besides the fact the issue is very near and dear to my heart. Did you know that in the United States, 2.7 million children currently have a parent in prison, and it's estimated that 10 million children have experienced parental incarceration at some point in their lives? I was one of these kids, and as an adult, I am really grateful to be able to give back to Project Avery. Their mission is to build leadership from within by supporting community through programs such as mentoring and outdoor education, and also to remove the stigma surrounding having a parent that's incarcerated. You don't have to feel alone. If you know a kid who could use these resources or would like to donate money or time to the charity, please go to Project Avery, that's AVARY.org, to check out what this amazing charity is all about. Again, that's ProjectAvery.org. Thank you guys, from the bottom of my heart.